Since the 1950s, my guest Jerry Mulligan has been perhaps the leading baritone saxophonist in jazz. He's also made his mark as an arranger, writing for the Gene Krupa Band, the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool Sessions, and his own bands. In the early 1950s, Mulligan moved from New York to the West Coast and formed a quartet with Chet Baker. The group played a more temperate approach to bop that became known as cool jazz or West Coast jazz. This week, Mulligan is playing with the New York Philharmonic, which is performing two pieces he composed and arranged. This music is also featured on his recent album, Symphonic Dreams. I asked Jerry Mulligan what he keeps in mind when he's writing music for classical musicians who aren't used to playing jazz.
What I tried to accomplish in my piece was writing something that the orchestra was comfortable playing. In other words, writing rhythmically in a way that was their idiom, not trying to force the orchestra to play the jazz idiom. The orchestra has its own ways of swinging, you know. The whole sense of momentum comes organically from the orchestra. They don't have a rhythm section. So producing that sense of momentum, you have to go about it in different ways. And there are ways that are the musical language that the orchestra is used to, and that's what I tried to call upon, not trying to impose a strange idiom on them. That's especially on the piece called Entente, because that's a solo piece with the orchestra. The other piece that we played is a piece for the quartet with the written with an orchestral arrangement. That, of course, presents another set of problems, because when you put a rhythm section with an orchestra, you run into acoustic problems that you don't run into otherwise. You know, the presence of drums and cymbals, for instance. Cymbals have a tendency to ring in just the registers that are already occupied by the strings and woodwinds and tend to wipe them out. So each of these things presents particular problems, and so you have to use logic to solve them.
Well, let me play an excerpt of the Entente for baritone, saxophone, and orchestra. It's one of the pieces you'll be playing with the New York Philharmonic, and you recorded it a couple of years ago on an album called Symphonic Dreams,
right? Mm-hmm.
Which features you along with the Houston Symphony conducted by Eric Kunzel. Mm-hmm. So this is the Entente. the Entente for baritone saxophone and orchestra, composed and arranged by my guest Jerry Mulligan, and this is one of the pieces he's performing in a series of concerts with the New York Philharmonic. Let's go backwards a little bit. You went on the road when you were a teenager. Was this against your parents' wishes, or did they think that that was okay?
Well, I think my parents accepted it as inevitable, and so they didn't stand in my way. I actually left high school to go on the road as an arranger with a band. And since that's what I wanted to do, and there was really no opportunity for me to go to music school, I insisted, and I got my way.
As you say, you went on the road as an arranger. One of your early arranging jobs was with the Gene Krupa band.
Mm-hmm.
Were you playing at all in the band at the beginning?
Not in the beginning, no. What happened, because I was a saxophone player and I always had at least one horn with me, if somebody got sick or somebody left unexpectedly, I would get called into service to help out. So that happened a couple of times during the year that I was with Gene Krupa's band. And it was a good experience because there were wonderful players in the band. I learned a great deal, but I felt like I was in deep water because I didn't feel that I was half the saxophone player that those other men were.
You were playing tenor, alto, and baritone at the time?
No, at first I played alto with the band for a while. The alto player left in the beginning of a tour, and I wound up having to play. And then some nights with the lead alto player got the flu or something happened to him, and I wound up coming to the job that night, finding out I had to play lead alto in the first the first crack out of the box. We were doing a radio show.
Oh, great.
That's called Learning Under Fire.
Yeah. Well, how did you start specializing on baritone?
I don't know. It's one of those things I never really remember thinking about. I bought a baritone when I was still in high school and never played it. I just got it because I liked it. I loved the way the baritone sounded in the band, and especially Harry Carney with the Duke Ellington band. And I suppose if I had been a string player rather than play violin, I probably would have chosen to play cello. And it probably has something to similar in choosing the baritone over the alto or the tenor, because it's in a similar register.
Mm-hmm. In the late 40s, you teamed up with arranger Gil Evans for what became one of the key recording sessions of modern jazz, the sessions that became known as the Birth of the Cool, mm-hmm. with Miles Davis and the Nonette. How did you and Evans first get together for these sessions?
Well, being an arranger with the band, I met the arrangers for all the other bands, and there was always a kind of a sense of camaraderie between the arrangers that's separate from the other players. And I became very close with Gil. I loved the way he wrote. That Thornhill band had a very orchestral approach because Claude Thornhill himself was a pianist whose whole approach was very Debussy-like. He loved the French Impressionists, and he gave that kind of aura to the band, the way the things were orchestrated and the use of French horns and clarinets in the ensemble was quite unique at that time.
When you were writing for the Nonette, did you see that as a compromise between a big band and a small group?
Well, it's I suppose compromise is a word. We never thought of it as a compromise. What we were looking for was a vehicle that would give us the kind of rhythmic freedom that you have with a small group, with something of the orchestral colors that you have with the large ensemble. And what we wound up with there was really kind of a basic cut down in size version of the Thornhill band. And having the six horns gave us a tremendous sense of ensemble.
Well, let's hear something from The Birth of the Cool. This is Giroux, composed and arranged by my guest baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. baritone saxophonist, composer, and arranger Jerry Mulligan is my guest, and he's currently performing in a series of concerts with the New York Philharmonic. That's through December 19th, and they're playing several of his compositions. In the early 1950s, you moved to the West Coast. What brought you there?
Well, things were pretty rough in New York at that point. There were the places to work got fewer and fewer, and it was hard to make a living here. And the big bands that I had depended on to make a living were starting to die out. You know, the economy changed. And so I left New York and went to California to look for the land of opportunity.
And what you found there was trumpeter Chet Baker. And you formed a quartet with him that ended up being the kind of seminal band that would define the sound that became known as the West Coast Sound or cool jazz. Tell me how you teamed up with Baker.
Well, when I went to California, I first started out through friends writing arrangements for Stan Kenton's band. And I used to spend a lot of time going around to jam sessions all over the Los Angeles area. And I encountered Chet a few times at sessions, and I liked very much the way he played. He had a very melodic approach, and he was a wonderful player. And so when it came time to put together something to take into a club to go to work, I finally wound up settled on this instrumentation with Chet. And so it was just a thing of proximity and opportunity, and it turned out to be the land of opportunity.
One of the things that distinguished your quartet was that it was a modern jazz group that didn't have a piano. Why didn't you have one?
Well, there were a couple of reasons for that, but the main reason was that the club we went into was a little place called The Hague in near downtown Los Angeles. When I first was playing on the off nights at this club, the main attraction in the club was Errol Garner. They had this beautiful concert grand piano on the stage. Well, the group following Errol was the trio of Red Norvo. Well, Red's instrumentation was, played the vibraphone, and he had a guitarist and a bass player. I think Charlie Mingus was with him then. And so they took this beautiful big grand piano out, and so I was going to play on the off night. I said, well, they'll bring in a little upright. I said, no, you won't. I said, to go from this beautiful grand to upright, I won't do it. So I said, I'll put together a group that doesn't need a piano. And so it allowed me to put into practice something that we'd already tried in New York, rhythm section without a piano, and it worked very well.
Well, let me play something from your quartet with Chet Baker. This is a 1953 recording. It's your composition called Line for Lions. I guess Jerry Mulligan with Chet Baker, their recording of Line for Lions from 1953. Well, while you were in the West Coast, you actually spent 3.5 months in a California prison on drug charges. You had been, you'd become addicted to heroin, as many of the jazz musicians of that time had become. Were you, what kind of prison were you in, and what was your life like while you were there?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant. And as far as prisons go, I suppose it wasn't very difficult because it was, I guess, a medium security compound out in the country north of Los Angeles. And some of the people in the prison, the guards and the wardens and all that, were very nice, and some were terrible. And they had, as I suppose they usually do, they had the people who were in there for various narcotics possessions were kind of kept together, and so it was... It could have been a lot worse. And the funny thing was, when as soon as I got there, it turns out that the people who were involved in the prison work of called the care and treatment, I mean, they had the big battle going between the people said the prison is for punishment, and the other people saying, well, prison is for rehabilitation. And these people are always fighting with each other to get the upper hand, you know. Well, I no more than arrived in this place, and the care and treatment people came up and said, would you write a Christmas show for us? Said, sure. Well, that created a great deal of resentment with the people who thought that I was supposed to be being punished. And I found myself having a very hard time with some of the guards who were, you know, kind of the traditional sadistic types.
Huh.
And so it's kind of a pulling match between one and the other. And, well... I wound up putting a little band together and writing music for them, but wound up never doing the show because an organization called Narcotics Anonymous got a hold of a good lawyer. I had been very unlucky in the choice of lawyer. He was just a stupid man. I found out later that a lot of people that he had represented used to do things like put sugar in his gas tank and various things because he was such a rotten person. And it was very bad luck to wind up with somebody. Well, anyway, this organization and friends managed to get a rehearing, and they modified my sentence to time served and let me out. It was kind of a thing right out of a movie. It was, I think, the day or two before Christmas, and they took me into the down into the city to go to the court to have this hearing. And I think that the bus or the car that I was in to go down there got stuck in traffic, so by the time we got there, the hearing was already over, and I had been released. And it must have totally stunned the other people that I was in prison with, because they said nobody gets modified on a short sentence. It was a six-month sentence to begin with. And so that was amazing. So the day before Christmas, I was released.
I want to ask you about a story that Nat Hentoff told in a New Yorker profile of you years ago. And he told the story of how when you were arranging with the Gene Krupa band, and this was in the 1940s, you were very young, one night, on the bandstand with the audience there, you started chewing out the band for being sloppy and telling Krupa that, you know, he was irresponsible for allowing that sloppiness to happen. Pretty nervy for a young musician.
Yes, but I did not tell Gene Krupa off for allowing it to happen.
Oh, okay.
But what happened was, it wasn't a night in New York. We had a long plane trip into Atlantic City, New Jersey, or someplace, and we were playing in the afternoon. And yes, you know, it was a thing that's always kind of amazed me about myself is that I was a terrible sideman, because I was always, you know, I kind of elected myself the conscience, the musical conscience of the band. And you do things like that when you're young. You're idealistic and so on. But I didn't learn how to be a good sideman in a band until after I'd been a leader and realized what you really should contribute. I didn't know how to contribute to the organization in terms of attitude. And so I was kind of a bristly person in that way.
So maybe you don't have the temperament to be a sideman.
That's true.
Maybe you have to be a leader.
Well, I think that's right. There are a lot of things about being a sideman that are so far from my personality. I could never be a studio musician to play music and learn it and play it once and that's the end of it. Music is, to me, something that has to live every day. And when I play a piece of music that I like, I want to play it a lot. I don't want to just play it once. So yeah, I think you're right. There's a little bit of a personality problem there to be a success playing with a band.
Well, Jerry Mulligan, I thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Pleasure.